Welcome to the Federal Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federal Society's Litigation Practice Group, was recorded on Wednesday, February 7th, 2018, during a live telephone conference call held exclusively for Federalist Society members.
Welcome to the Federalist Society's telephone conference call. This afternoon, we will be discussing the after effects of the Bristol-Myers Squibb decision. My name is Laura Flint. I'm the Deputy Director of Practice Groups here at the Federalist Society. As always, please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the expert on today's call. Today, we are happy to have with us Sean M. Murata, Senior Associate at Hogan Lovells. After remarks from Sean, we'll go to audience question and answer. Thank you for speaking with us, Sean. The floor is yours.
Thank you so much, and thank you, everyone, for joining. As mentioned, my name is Sean Murata, and I'm a Senior Associate in the Hogan Lovells Appellate Supreme Court Practice Group. I was on the team that briefed and won the Bristol-Myers Squibb versus Superior Court case in the Supreme Court last year, and I represent a major automotive manufacturer across the United States on personal jurisdiction issues. But as always, everything I say today reflects my views and my views alone, not that of Hogan Lovells or any of the clients I represent. We'll be talking today about the Supreme Court's two personal jurisdiction decisions from the 2016 term, Bristol-Myers Squibb versus Superior Court and BNSF versus Tyrell. But rather than talk in depth about just the cases, we wanted to discuss what is happening after Bristol-Myers and BNSF. What are the challenges and opportunities on the horizon for defendants that are seeking to assert their due process rights after these cases? But first, as one always has to do in these briefings, let's start with a little bit of background on what personal jurisdiction is, Bristol-Myers, and the BNSF cases. Personal jurisdiction at its core is about a defendant's right under the 14th Amendment to be free from certain interference by way of lawsuit in certain places. In other words, personal jurisdiction refers to a state court's power to haul a defendant before it and impose a personal judgment against it or its property. The 14th Amendment restrains that because, as the court has explained, federalism concerns mean that a defendant should not be subject to the coercive power of another state when they do not have certain minimum contacts or sufficient contacts with that state. And in the Bristol-Myers and BNSF decisions last year, the Supreme Court explained what it means by that. Personal jurisdiction comes in two forms. One is called general or all-purpose jurisdiction. General jurisdiction means you can be subject to suit in that state for literally anything that someone might have a lawsuit for you against, regardless of whether the lawsuit has any connection to the state. So, for instance, it doesn't matter under general jurisdiction if a car accident occurred in California and you live in New Jersey, you can be sued in New Jersey for that car accident because New Jersey has general jurisdiction over you. Specific jurisdiction, on the other hand, which is the form of jurisdiction that is talked most about today, refers to claims or lawsuits that arise from the defendant's contacts with the state. In other words, it has something to do with what you did in the state. So in my example of a California car accident, the fact you drove in the state and hit someone there would create the sufficient contacts such that you can be sued in California for that lawsuit, for that car accident, but not anything else. So in the Bristol-Myers Squibb and BNSF decisions, the Supreme Court explained both specific jurisdiction in Bristol-Myers and general jurisdiction in BNSF. The Bristol-Myers decision was a specific jurisdiction case. Very briefly, it had to do with an aggregated set of lawsuits against Bristol-Myers Squibb involving its drug Plavix. The plaintiffs all claimed that they took Plavix and suffered side effects. But the plaintiffs came from all over the United States. Some small percentage of them lived in California, took Plavix in California, and were injured in California. And for them, Bristol-Myers Squibb agreed that it was perfectly okay for them to sue in California. After all, what Bristol-Myers Squibb did in California, sell these people Plavix through their pharmacies, was related to their claims that they brought in California, the injuries that they suffered. But as for the people from across the United States, the people from Texas, the people from West Virginia, and elsewhere, Bristol-Myers Squibb said that there was no connection between their lawsuits and what Bristol-Myers Squibb did in the state. Sure, Bristol-Myers Squibb admitted, we have some business in California. In fact, we have a lot of business in California. But these particular claims, Bristol-Myers Squibb said, had nothing to do with what we did in the state. The California courts disagreed, holding under existing California precedent that specific jurisdiction had a sliding scale. That meant that the more contacts you had with the state, the less connection there had to be between what the defendant did in the state and the lawsuit. And what the California Supreme Court said by a bare 4-3 majority is that because Bristol-Myers Squibb does a lot of work in the state, and because all of the claims sounded more or less the same, they were all product cases, that was enough for all of the suits to be brought in California. And in the Supreme Court, the plaintiffs continued to press that argument, saying that, well, look, it makes sense. It's efficient for us to aggregate lawsuit in California. After all, since Bristol-Myers Squibb admits it has to face the California plaintiffs in California, how could it hurt, how could it be inconvenient for Bristol-Myers Squibb to face a lawsuit there for everyone? The Supreme Court disagreed. It pointed out that personal jurisdiction is not just about convenience of the defendant, although it does have something to do with that. It's also about, more broadly, the federalism interest among the many states. As Justice Kennedy pointed out in oral argument, it doesn't make sense and is somewhat patronizing to West Virginia or Ohio for California to say, we're going to be the decider of all national tort litigation because that's where the plaintiff's bar wants to bring its lawsuits. And the notions of federalism mean that states should regulate conduct that occurs in their state and not have to give it up to other states that have become destinations for forum shopping. And so what the court explained was is that as for the non-California plaintiffs, they could not bring their claims in California because there was simply no nexus between Bristol-Myers Squibb's California activities, their particular claims that arose where generally the plaintiffs lived, and the state of California. It further went on to emphasize that a personal jurisdiction is a plaintiff by plaintiff and possibly a claim by claim analysis. In other words, you couldn't lump all of the plaintiffs together and simply say that there is a lawsuit that has some sort of connection with California. And it further emphasized that due process has to do with the defendant, not the plaintiff. So the fact it might be inconvenient for the plaintiffs to have to sue in other places doesn't mean that it was proper to bring Bristol-Myers Squibb into California's jurisdiction. In the BNSF case, by contrast, the court reaffirmed what it had to say about general jurisdiction in its earlier 24 decision in Daimler AG versus Bauman. In the BNSF case, two plaintiffs, Tyrell and another, brought suit in Montana for claims arising under the Federal Employees Liability Act, which deals with certain injuries on the job on railroads. Although neither plaintiff worked for BNSF in Montana, the plaintiffs brought these claims in Montana because Montana is viewed as a friendly jurisdiction for Federal Employee Liability Act or FELA claims. BNSF argued that there was no general jurisdiction over it in Montana because although it does have some employees there, it has some railway there, and it derives some revenue from Montana, it is paled in comparison to the rest of BNSF's operations elsewhere. It was, in other words, a small fraction of what BNSF did in the state. And the Supreme Court agreed. It reaffirmed its rule from Daimler AG versus Bauman that a company is typically only at home and therefore subject to general jurisdiction only where it is incorporated or has its principal place of business, which is synonymous with its headquarters typically. And because there is neither of those typical cases there, BNSF isn't headquartered or incorporated in Montana, and because its operations are a mere fraction in Montana as opposed to the rest of the country, there could be no general jurisdiction. The court also emphasized that although some plaintiffs had tried to downplay the Daimler decision by emphasizing that it involved a foreign plaintiff suing a foreign defendant in a domestic court, that its general jurisdiction test, that at-home test, applies equally to any kind of case brought in the United States courts. It is not merely limited to foreign plaintiffs and foreign defendants. It's the test for all general jurisdiction. So with that background in mind, let's talk about what is on the horizon for personal jurisdiction in the future. What are plaintiffs going to be arguing? What are defendants going to be arguing? And what questions are the courts and possibly the Supreme Court going to have to face in the future? I think the first takeaway from Bristol-Myers is that we still don't have a standard for relatedness. Specific jurisdiction, to briefly recap, requires three things. First, a defendant has to do business or have some contact with the state. Second, the plaintiff's claims have to arise out of or relate to those contacts with the state. And finally, jurisdiction in the state has to be fair. But yet, even after Bristol-Myers Squibb, the court has never really defined what it means to arise out of or relate to a defendant's contacts in the state. It does state several principles for specific jurisdiction that are bare on the relatedness question. It says, for instance, that relatedness is not a sliding scale. In other words, a greater showing of contacts does not make up for a non-existent showing of relatedness. It says that unrelated business contacts in the state don't count. So in other words, just because you can point to some sales, some research, or something that has nothing to do with the plaintiff's claims in the state, that isn't enough for relatedness. And it says at the very least that relatedness is a plaintiff by plaintiff, if not claim by claim analysis. But Justice Sotomayor's dissent in Bristol-Myers Squibb points out the majority stops short of embracing a causal or proximate cause test for relatedness, leaving the division among the state circuits and state high courts. And so what does that mean? Before Bristol-Myers Squibb, and it was argued in the Bristol-Myers Squibb petition for writ of certiorari, that there is essentially a three-way split on what arise out of or relates to means. On the one hand, some courts hold that there has to be a proximate cause standard. In other words, there has to be both but-for causation and you can weed out certain even but-for causes that are not sufficiently important or weighty. And so what does but-for mean? Well, it means the same thing it means in tort. It means that but-for the defendant's contacts with the forum, the plaintiff's claims would not have arisen. In other words, you put yourself in a counterfactual situation. Imagine a world in which the defendant has no contacts in the state, doesn't do any business there, doesn't have any employees there, doesn't sell anything there. You ask yourself, in those circumstances, would the plaintiff still have claims? What would the story of his claims be? And if the plaintiff plaintiff's claims would be exactly the same, then the defendant can't be subject to personal jurisdiction there. Other circuits and other courts have said that it's just a but-for standard. In other words, all you ask is, but for the defendant's contacts with the forum, would the plaintiff have a claim? And then you stop. You don't ask, well, even though there might be but-for causation, is it sufficiently weighty or important contacts that would make relatedness proper? And to take a common example that was in the law review literature, imagine that I am sued for legal malpractice here in Washington, D.C. Could the plaintiff go to the state of Virginia, where I went to law school, and say, well, there is but-for causation in this case, because if Sean had never gone to law school, he would have never become a lawyer, and therefore he would have never committed legal malpractice. Therefore, Sean's contacts with the state of Virginia, going to law school there, is a but-for cause of my claims. In jurisdictions where there's just a but-for standard, they would say that that satisfies relatedness. But in states where they say that there is a proximate cause standard, they would likely say there's no personal jurisdiction or at least no relatedness because the mere fact that I happen to go to law school in Virginia really has nothing to do with the lawsuit. It just happens to be something that is in the causal chain somewhere. And by contrast, some courts have said that there is not a causal standard at all. In other words, they would say that all there has to be is some showing of relatedness, and relatedness doesn't have to be a but-for or proximate cause standard. And even within those courts that had a non-causal standard, some courts are more picky than others. Texas, for instance, has a fairly demanding non-causal standard, requiring that the contacts be of the sort that are important to the lawsuit. So in other words, you know, in the seminal case from Texas, a minor was out on a camping trip with a tour company in another state and fell and was injured. The Texas Supreme Court said that the mere fact that the company advertised in Texas was not enough to create specific jurisdiction, even under its non-causal test. Other states like California before Bristol-Myers Squibb and the District of Columbia have a fairly loose non-causal test, with D.C., for instance, saying that, well, yes, it's true that the plaintiff slipped and fell in the district in the Commonwealth of Virginia, but the supermarket advertises in both the district and in Virginia, so that is sufficient relatedness to bring the slip and fall claims in the district. It's unclear to what extent those very loose non-causal tests exist after Bristol-Myers Squibb, but by the Supreme Court declining to offer a test, personal jurisdiction continues to be something that's argued by analogy rather than by any predictable uniform standard that defendants can point to. And to take it from the abstract to the concrete, let me mention two examples that reoccur in the case law where a standard would be helpful, where it would be helpful to know what the relatedness standard is. The first is the case where you have a product defect suit and the injury occurred in the forum state. So to take an example, suppose I buy a set of skis in Vermont while I'm out there, and then I bring them home with me to Wyoming. The manufacturer, it turns out, sells the exact same kind of skis in Wyoming. Same brand, same make, same model. I then take those skis and go down the slope in Wyoming, and I'm injured. In that particular case, you would say that there's no but-for cause, and I bring suit in Wyoming where I live. In that case, there is no but-for cause between what the defendant did, which is selling me skis in Vermont, and my injury, which happened to occur in Wyoming. The Bristol-Myers Squibb decision suggests there would be no personal jurisdiction there, because what the Bristol-Myers Squibb decision says, citing its earlier decision in Walden, is that mere foreseeable injury to a plaintiff in the foreign state is not enough. And to explain why there's no but-for cause in my case, even if the ski company had never sold any skis in Wyoming, I still would have bought my skis in Vermont, and I still would have brought them to Wyoming with me, and I still would have gone down the slope in Wyoming, and I'd still be hurt in Wyoming. So we can't say that the defendant's contacts were with Wyoming had any but-for relationship to my injury. So again, Bristol-Myers Squibb, talking about the court's earlier decision in Walden versus Fior, where it says that even though a foreseeable injury occurred to the plaintiff in the forum state is not enough, would suggest that there's no personal jurisdiction in that case. But because the court has never said that it's a but-for standard, there's really no certainty in the lower courts on this recurring fact pattern. In fact, the fact pattern I just gave you is drawn from a Tenth Circuit case where it found no specific jurisdiction under a but-for standard. And quite frankly, cases in the district courts are all over the map on this particular fact pattern, with some relying on the so-called stream of commerce to say that there is jurisdiction even without but-for causation, and others following the but-for causation and saying that there is no personal jurisdiction over the defendant. But again, because the Supreme Court hasn't told us if it's a but-for standard, we see that disarray on a very common set of facts. The second example I'll give comes from pharmaceutical product defect cases. In the wake of Bristol-Myers Squibb, plaintiff's bar is still looking for a way to keep their cases in their preferred forums. And so what they do is they argue that because pharmaceutical manufacturers set up so-called study sites, places where a new drug is going to be studied in patients all across the United States, suit on all of the product defect claims can be brought any place there's a study site. So to give an example, suppose a drug is tested in Illinois and California and a couple different other places because that's where the doctors who are conducting the study happen to be located. Plaintiff's counsel argue that all of the drug defect suits can be brought in Illinois or California because, they argue, but for that study site, there would have been that the study site contributes to the safety information regarding the drug, and had there not been this defective process in designing or testing the drug, then there would have been adequate warnings, or the drug would have been decided differently or designed differently, and then their client would not have been hurt. It's not clear under those circumstances whether there's even but-for causation, because it's unclear how much one study site out of perhaps dozens contributes to the overall design of a drug. But even if you accept there's but-for causation in that case, it's not clear that there's proximate causation, because again, 10 or 12 or 15 patients enrolled in a nationwide trial in a particular state don't meaningfully contribute to the overall safety. And it's not clear that any of the plaintiff's claims have anything to do with the Illinois study site. It might just be something that's out there. But at least in the Illinois appellate court and in some district courts, judges have accepted this sort of argument, saying that, well, that's a close enough but-for relatedness test such that there can be personal jurisdiction over the claims in the state. But again, there's an ongoing split on this. A Missouri district court on roughly those same facts said that there was not personal jurisdiction over the drug manufacturer because the study was minor and fairly unimportant. So those are two examples that we're going to see come up in the case law, and I think we're again going to see someone go to the Supreme Court and say, you really need to give us a test. We need a strict, we need a understandable standard for what this relatedness thing means. But until we do, I think we're going to see a continuing disagreement among the district courts and among perhaps the appellate courts on facts that routinely recur in the case law. Another issue that we're going to see after Bristol-Myers Squibb is, can there be general jurisdiction other than the paradigm places of where a corporation is incorporated or headquartered? The court has never said that those are the only places, saying that they're only the typical or exemplar places. And it gave an example of its earlier decision in Perkins, where it said that's the kind of exceptional case where a company could be at home outside of where it's incorporated and where it's headquartered. You might ask whether it was really, because in Perkins, it was a Philippine mining company that during World War II and the invasion of the Philippines temporarily relocated its operations to Ohio. So you might say in those cases that actually the principal place of business was in Ohio. But regardless, that's at least the kind of case that the court has thought is not could result in general jurisdiction outside of where a company is incorporated and headquartered. And until the court says that those are the only two places, plaintiffs will continue to try to argue that their states qualify for special treatment. In particular, you see this in large states like New York and California and Texas, where a company may have quite extensive commercial contacts there, mostly because of the size of the states and their importance to American economy. After all, if you're not in the California market to any great degree and you're a national company, that's quite unusual. And that's going to relate to the next point I'll talk about, discovery. But until the court finally clamps down and says, no, when we say the exemplar places, we mean those are really the only places, absent some sort of showing of a temporary headquarters move like in Perkins, we'll continue to see plaintiffs try to weasel their way out of it. Relatedly, we're going to see the continuing battles over jurisdictional discovery. Plaintiffs are going to continue to propound discovery, looking for every contact with a state that a defendant might have for two reasons. One, plaintiffs are going to be looking for some sort of causal or but-for connection, such as when they're trying to find those study sites like in the pharmaceutical cases. But I think more generally, plaintiffs are going to be looking for a way to grind a defendant into withdrawing the personal jurisdiction motion. After all, if you have to interrupt the commercial running of your business to go hunt down how many employees you have in a state, you know, every contract you have with the state, every time you've communicated with someone in the state, these are the kinds of examples of interrogatories that are propounded. You might be tempted to just withdraw the jurisdictional objection and get on with the case. How much the courts are willing to put up with these sort of broad requests, particularly in the face of Daimler and BNSF, is unclear. partly Daimler and BNSF have been unhelpful because although they say that general jurisdiction is not just a quantitative analysis, it's a qualitative analysis, they often go on to give the ratios. They say that there are only X percentage of employees or only Y percentage of revenue is derived from the state. So with the court mentioning those particular features of Daimler and BNSF, plaintiffs will continue to seek that information and defendants will have to continue to provide it. With most national companies, their sales will probably be fairly proportional to the state's role in the national economy, but it's still information that's going to have to be dredged up from inside the business and can throw a wrench into the normal functioning of the business and therefore be disruptive. In federal court, judges may be more attuned to these types of fishing expeditions, and they have circuit case law saying that plaintiffs must make a prima facie showing as to the relevance of the material they seek. In other words, plaintiffs might have to show, well, what is the best thing you think your discovery might find? And if so, how is it going to prove personal jurisdiction? But in state court, where discovery standards tend to be looser and state trial judges perhaps less willing to quash personal jurisdiction discovery, defendants may have to produce documents, enter interrogatories, or even put up a corporate representative for a deposition. I think we're going to see more state court case law about these jurisdictional discovery issues, and there's in fact a case in front of the Texas Supreme Court right now on the relevant standard for jurisdictional discovery after Daimler. Before I turn it over to questions, let me also mention two more areas where I think we're going to see personal jurisdiction in the future. One is so-called consent by registration. And this theory is based on a 1920s and earlier set of cases from the U.S. Supreme Court that held in the era before the modern International Shoe versus Washington case that if a company registers to do business in a state and if the state statutes deem that consent to do consent to general jurisdiction, that is all-purpose jurisdiction in the state, that is acceptable under the Due Process Clause. And there's a reason that the court said that in 1920 and earlier, because before you have the modern notion of specific jurisdiction, a corporation to be subject to suit in a state either had to be physically located in the state, which generally meant where it was incorporated, or it had to quote-unquote consent. So courts tried to find ways to imply consent to try to create something akin to what we call specific jurisdiction today. The Supreme Court's later cases, starting with International Shoe and then on to a case called Schaefer versus Heitner, have continued to point out that the consent that was present during this earlier era was a fiction. Nobody actually agreed to general jurisdiction. It's just something that courts said to try to create specific jurisdiction in an era that didn't have it. But yet, to this day, plaintiffs are now rediscovering consent by registration and arguing that large national corporations, many of whom have registered to do business in all 50 states, or at least every state where they have sales and employees, have somehow consented to general jurisdiction by doing so, and thus bringing in through the back door all of the national aggregated class actions and mass actions that Bristol-Myers Squibb and that Daimler said aren't permissible. Thankfully for defendants, the trend has been to reject consent by registration. Most courts that have confronted the issue after Daimler have said, and those state courts that have done so not by reaching the constitutional issue, saying that it violates the Due Process Clause, but rather by saying that our state corporate laws, which generally require a defendant to register to do business and to appoint an agent for service of process, don't have anything to say about general jurisdiction. Service of process, after all, just says how do you get the summons and complaint to the defendant? Personal jurisdiction, on the other hand, is quite different. Personal jurisdiction is about the power to exercise authority over the corporation. And what these state high courts have said, including the Illinois Supreme Court, the Wisconsin Supreme Court, the Delaware Supreme Court, the Oregon Supreme Court, and the New Jersey Appellate Division, have all said is we just don't see anything in our state statutes that suggests that the drafters intended to create consent to general personal jurisdiction out of them. So although that's a heartening trend, there are some jurisdictions and some circuits and state appellate courts where both pre- and post-Daimler we're seeing a continued embrace of consent by registration. So for instance, in Minnesota, in New York, in most notably Pennsylvania, which has a large asbestos docket and is a very popular forum for plaintiffs seeking to bring asbestos claims, there are still continued arguments and some holdings in the trial courts that consent by registration remains good law after Daimler. There are some appeals, including in New York and in Minnesota, but in Pennsylvania in particular, the state trial court has been unwilling to certify the question for interlocutory appeal, and the state appellate court has been unwilling to require it to certify the issue for interlocutory appeal. And so what you've seen is defendants continuing to fight in the Philadelphia asbestos docket, trying to find a way to get this issue up for appeal and possibly for U.S. Supreme Court resolution. But until then, you're seeing these large nationwide companies continue to be hauled into Pennsylvania under this consent by registration theory. The final thing I wanted to talk about is nationwide class actions after Bristol-Myers Squibb. As I mentioned a couple times before, Bristol-Myers Squibb said that personal jurisdiction is at least a plaintiff-by-plaintiff, if not a claim-by-claim analysis. So what then is the implication for nationwide class actions? Some nationwide class actions are brought in a favored forum for plaintiffs' counsel, where they have some class representatives that are located in the forum state, just like the California plaintiffs in Bristol-Myers Squibb. And there are many class representatives who are from states outside of the forum state. And there is an argument that all of them can be brought into a class inside the forum. I'd say before Bristol-Myers Squibb and before Daimler, there wasn't much of a personal jurisdiction fight around them, because for the sort of corporations that are class action targets, it was generally thought they were subject to general jurisdiction in the state, or it just wasn't something on defendants' radars. But now, after Bristol-Myers Squibb and after Daimler and after BNSF, corporate defendants are realizing that trying to aggregate a class in that way of in-state and out-of-state class representatives, and thus in-state and out-of-state absent class members of a class is certified, might not be appropriate because the state court might not have jurisdiction over the absent members' class claims. So they're arguing to strike the class allegations from the very beginning of the case, or they may be arguing that a class can't be certified of a nationwide class because of that, because there won't be personal jurisdiction. And they might be arguing that currently certified classes should be decertified. We don't have much agreement as to how Bristol-Myers Squibb applies to nationwide class actions yet. Some district courts have read the tea leaves and said that nationwide class actions are not proper anymore. So in other words, you can't certify a class that includes those who, if they were there on their own, would not have specific jurisdiction over their claims. And other courts have said, particularly in the multi-district litigation context, that the benefits in federal court of aggregated litigation are simply not addressed by Bristol-Myers Squibb, and that they continue to be proper. And we saw that particularly in the multi-district litigation context, with the court saying that because the point of multi-district litigation is to bring cases into a single forum, the kinds of concerns raised by Bristol-Myers Squibb don't necessarily apply. And given the continuing fights around class certification, and given that class certification can often be what makes or breaks a case, and dictate a defendant's willingness to settle, we're going to see a lot more fights around that, and the motion to strike class allegations is probably going to be part of the standard class action defense playbook moving forward. So with that, I'll turn it over to questions and just say that although Bristol-Myers Squibb and BNSF were certainly very important cases, they didn't answer everything about personal jurisdiction, and they, in fact, left many very important questions open. So the hope of some in the bar that Bristol-Myers Squibb and BNSF were going to be clarifying or seminal decisions that are going to put personal jurisdiction to rest, I think in many ways are going to be disappointed, and we're going to see personal jurisdiction to even be more of a question up and down the appellate system. So with that, let me turn it over to questions.
Let's go to audience questions. In a moment, you'll hear a prompt indicating that the floor mode has been turned on. After that, to request the floor, enter star, then the pound key. When we get to your request, you will hear a prompt, and then you may ask your question. We will answer questions in the order in which they are received. Again, to ask a question, please enter star, then the pound key on your telephone keypad. Let's go to our first audience question.
Sean, I was interested in your thoughts on limits on federal court personal jurisdiction. I know that some people argue that, well, the federal system is all one big jurisdiction, and so if the federal government wants to allow a driver in a car accident in Maine to be sued in Hawaii, they could do so, and that the limits on state jurisdiction don't apply. But it seems to me that cases like BMS are based on the idea that it's unfair to defendants to be hauled to very inconvenient forums, that perhaps there ought to be some due process limits on federal jurisdiction, such as, for example, in MDLs, where people get drawn all across the country. I'm wondering what you see there as any application of BMS to the federal courts.
Certainly. So in Bristol-Myers Squibb, as it had in all of its earlier cases, including Daimler and including Jaina Castro, the Supreme Court has reserved the question of whether different or the same personal jurisdiction concerns apply in federal court when Congress or the rulemakers are acting under the Fifth Amendment, because remember, the 14th Amendment applies to the states and the Fifth Amendment applies to the federal government. In general, the lower courts have held that when Congress wants, it can extend the jurisdiction of the federal courts up to the full limits of the Fifth Amendment, which is to say that rather than looking at the defendant's contacts with a particular state, you would look at the defendant's contacts with the United States as a whole. So you would ask, has the defendant purposely availed himself of the privilege of doing business in the United States? Are the plaintiff's claims related to the defendant's activities in the United States? I think what most lower courts would say under the hypothetical you proposed, where somebody, you know, who has a car accident in New York and is forced to sue in Hawaii, I think you could perhaps argue that that could violate traditional notions of fair play and substantial justice, which is the third prong under personal jurisdiction, although in general it's quite hard to get a case kicked for personal jurisdiction under that third prong. And also, of course, there are other things like venue and forum non conveniens that the federal courts use to get rid of that case. In the district litigation context, the courts that have addressed the issue so far have tended to say that because the MDL statute implicitly invokes the Fifth Amendment and is really more about venue rather than personal jurisdiction. So in other words, you say there is sufficient personal jurisdiction with the forum where the case was filed, and then where the case is sent under the MDL statute is just a question of venue. The arguments that defendants have made saying that that's unfair have generally fallen, but you can certainly see after Bristol-Myers Squibb them taking another run at it. But thus far, the Supreme Court has very pointedly avoided the question, and the lower courts have said generally that Congress is not bound by the same sorts of restrictions.
Again, to ask a question, please enter star, then the pound key on your telephone keypad. While we wait for our next audience question, I'll make a brief announcement. Our next telephone conference call is scheduled for tomorrow, Thursday, February 8th. That call will be a Regulatory Transparency Project teleforum that will feature OIRA Administrator Naomi Rao. Again, to ask a question, please enter star, then the pound key on your telephone keypad. While we wait for our next question, I'll ask one of my own. When do you foresee the general jurisdiction question reappearing in the Supreme Court again?
I think it will be a while before we see another general jurisdiction case, at least a sort of straightforward general jurisdiction case that asks, is this corporation subject to general jurisdiction in the forum state? Even BNSF, which more or less reaffirmed the Daimler case, came up to the Supreme Court not so much on the general jurisdiction holding, but rather on a specific question of whether the Federal Employees Liability Act created jurisdiction in the state courts, and the Supreme Court held there wasn't. I think you're going to see it come up again in one of in really almost the summary reversal context, where if you get a state appellate court or a state high court that steps out and finds a national company subject to general jurisdiction in a state where the corporation isn't, where the corporation is more or less doing the same kind of national business that you would expect out of any national company, you could possibly see a corporation going to the Supreme Court and asking them to finally put this matter to rest. But until then, at least on the sort of general question of when a company is subject to general jurisdiction because of its extensive contacts in a state, state appellate courts and national appellate courts have been doing a pretty good job of holding that line. The only question is going to be if the state steps out and we see the issue go up again. I think what's far more likely is we're going to see general jurisdiction go up to the Supreme Court under the guise of the consent by registration issue I was discussing. The Supreme Court explicitly reserved in the BNSF decision whether consent by registration continues to be good law, saying that it wasn't decided by the Montana Supreme Court, and so they weren't going to address it in the first instance. But that is probably going to be the next big fight in general jurisdiction.
Again, to ask a question, please enter star, then the pound key on your telephone keypad. A reminder to keep an eye out for emails announcing upcoming teleforum calls and to consult the full schedule of our upcoming calls on the Federalist Society's website, fedsoc.org. Also available there are podcasts of previously recorded teleforum calls you may have missed. Again, to ask a question, please enter star, then the pound key on your telephone keypad. Not seeing one, I was wondering if you could elaborate on why the Supreme Court didn't give a definitive answer one way or the other on the question of a third jurisdiction when they knew it would probably bring up a lot of conflict between the circuits.
I think there are two reasons. One is that Bristol-Myers Squibb was argued in April and was decided in June. So just given that short turnaround, you often see outside the blockbuster cases, the Supreme Court puts out opinions that certainly address the question in front of it, but don't, I think, reach broader than that. And I think second and relatedly, Bristol-Myers Squibb had the benefit of being an 8-1 decision, which with all of the court except Justice Sotomayor, who has been a perennial dissenter in these cases, joining Justice Alito's opinion. And one can imagine that to hold together all eight justices, Justice Alito had to write his opinion more narrowly. Had he reached out and given a definitive answer that it's a but-for standard or it's a proximate cause standard, that might have led the court to break off into different directions with dissenting and concurring opinions. And even if perhaps there were five votes for a particular test, you can imagine the court, which tries to be minimalist when it can be in certain areas, might have wanted to hold an eight-justice majority together, and therefore they settled on a more limited and more fact-bound issue, waiting instead for another case to bring up the definitive test.
I'll make a final call for questions. Again, to ask a question, please enter star, then the pound key on your telephone keypad. Not seeing any, Sean, would you like to make some closing remarks?
I think I'll just close by saying that personal jurisdiction is going to be an important tool in the defense attorney's toolbox moving forward. Whereas before, when defense attorneys defended national corporations, they thought that personal jurisdiction challenges weren't worthwhile, either because the company would undoubtedly be subject to general jurisdiction in a state, or because the cost and expense of general jurisdiction discovery wouldn't make it worth it. You're now going to see more and more companies raise personal jurisdiction either as a way to get cases out of unfavorable forums or as a way to break up the kind of mass litigation we've seen in the past. So personal jurisdiction is going to be important. It should probably be something that every defense attorney assesses when a new case comes in and that companies should be thinking about as a strategy as part of their litigation toolbox if they haven't already.
On behalf of the Federalist Society, I want to thank our expert for the benefit of his valuable time and expertise today. We welcome listener feedback by email at info@fedsoc.org. Thank you all for joining us. We are adjourned.
Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at fedsoc.org/multimedia.